worthy, therefore, than one of Enid's silly fantasies. The suspicion that everything was relative, that the real and authentic might not be simply doomed, but fictive to begin with, that his feeling of righteousness, of uniquely championing the real, was just a feeling. These were the suspicions that had lain in ambush in all those motel rooms. These were the deep terrors beneath the flimsy beds. And if the world refused to square with his version of reality, then it was necessarily an uncaring world, a sour and sickening world, a penal colony. And he was doomed to be violently lonely in it. He bowed his head at the thought of how much strength a man would need to survive an entire life so lonely. He returned the pitiful, unbalanced electric chair to the floor of the prison's largest room. As soon as he let go of the chair, it fell on its side. Images of hammering the jail to bits passed through his head, flashes of hiked-up skirts and torn-down underpants, images of shredded bras and out-thrust hips, but came to nothing. Gary was sleeping in perfect silence, the way his mother did. There was no hope that he'd forgotten his father's implicit promise to look at the jail after dinner. Gary never forgot anything. "Still, I am doing my best," Alfred thought. Returning to the dining room, he noticed the change in the food on Chipper's plate. The well-browned margins of the liver had been carefully pared off and eaten, as had every scrap of crust. There was evidence as well that rutabaga had been swallowed. The small speck that remained was scored with tiny tine marks. And several beet greens had been dissected, the softer leaves removed and eaten, the woody reddish stems laid aside. It appeared that Chipper had taken the contractual one bite of each food after all, presumably at great personal cost, and had been put to bed without being given the dessert he'd earned. On a November morning, 35 years earlier, Alfred had found a coyote's bloody foreleg in the teeth of a steel trap, evidence of certain desperate hours in the previous night. There came an upwelling of pain, so intense that he had to clench his jaw and refer to his philosophy to prevent its turning into tears. Schopenhauer. Only one consideration may serve to explain the sufferings of animals. That the will to live, which underlies the entire world of phenomena, must in their case satisfy its cravings by feeding upon itself. He turned off the last lights downstairs, visited the bathroom, and put on fresh pajamas. He had to open his suitcase to retrieve his toothbrush. Into the bed, the Museum of Antique Transports, he slipped beside Enid, settling as close to the far edge as he could. She was asleep in her sleep-feigning way. He looked once at the alarm clock, the radium jewelry on its two pointing hands, closer to 12 now than to 11, and shut his eyes. Came the question in a voice like noon. "What were you talking about with Chuck?" His exhaustion redoubled. With his closed eyes he saw beakers and probes and the trembling needle of the ammeter. "It sounded like the Erie belt," Enid said. "Does Chuck know about that? Did you tell him?"
"Enid, I am very tired."
"I'm just surprised, that's all, considering."
"It was an accident, and I regret it."
"I just think it's interesting," Enid said, "that Chuck is allowed to make an investment that we're not allowed to make."
"If Chuck chooses to take unfair advantage of other investors, that's his business."
"A lot of Erie Belt shareholders would be happy to get 5 3/4 tomorrow. What's unfair about that?"
Her words had the sound of an argument rehearsed for hours, a grievance nursed in darkness. "Those shares will be worth $9.50 3 weeks from now," Alfred said. "I know it, and most people don't. That's unfair."
"You're smarter than other people," Enid said, "and you did better in school, and now you have a better job. That's unfair too, isn't it? Shouldn't you make yourself stupid, to be completely fair?"
chewing your own leg off, was not an act to be undertaken lightly or performed halfway. At what point and by what process did the coyote make the decision to sink its teeth into its own flesh? Presumably, there first came a period of waiting and weighing. But after that? "I'm not going to argue with you," Alfred said. "Since you are awake, however, I want to know why Chip wasn't put to bed. You were the one who said you came upstairs long before I did. It was not my intention that he sit there for 5 hours. You're using him against me, and I don't care for it one bit. He should have been put to bed at 8. Enid simmered in her wrongness. "Can we agree that this will not happen again?" Alfred said. "We can agree." "Well, then, let's sleep." When it was very, very dark in the house, the unborn child could see as clearly as anyone. She had ears and eyes, fingers, and a forebrain, and a cerebellum, and she floated in a central place. She already knew the main hungers. Day after day the mother walked around in a stew of desire and guilt. And now the object of the mother's desire lay 3 feet away from her. Everything in the mother was poised to melt and shut down at a loving touch anywhere on her body. There was a lot of breathing going on. A lot of breathing, but no touching. Sleep eluded even Alfred. Each sinusy gasp of Enid's seemed to pierce his ear the instant he was poised afresh to drop off. After an interval that he judged to have lasted 20 minutes, the bed began to shake with poorly reined sobs. He broke his silence, almost wailing, "What is it now?"
"Nothing."
"Enid, it is very, very late, and the alarm is set for 6, and I am bone-weary." She wept stormily.
"You never kissed me goodbye."
"I'm aware of that."
"Well, don't I have a right? A husband leaves his wife at home alone for 2 weeks."
"This is water under the bridge, and frankly, I've endured a lot worse."
"And then he comes home and doesn't even say hello. He just attacks me."
"Enid, I have had a terrible week." "And leaves the dinner table before dinner's over?" "A terrible week, and I am extraordinarily tired."
"And locks himself in the basement for 5 hours, even though he's supposedly very tired."
"If you had had the week I had..."
"You didn't kiss me goodbye."
"Grow up. For God's sake, grow up.
Keep your voice down."
"Keep your voice down, or the baby might hear." Indeed, did hear, and was soaking up every word. "Do you think I was on a pleasure cruise?" Alfred demanded in a whisper. "Everything I do for you and the boys. It's been 2 weeks since I had a minute to myself. I believe I'm entitled to a few hours in the laboratory. You would not understand it, and you would not believe me if you did, but I have found something very interesting."
"Oh, very interesting,"
Enid said, hardly the first time she'd heard this. "Well, it is very interesting."
"Something with commercial applications?"
"You never know. Look what happened to Jack Callahan. This could end up paying for the boy's education."
"I thought you said Jack Callahan's discovery was an accident."
"My God, listen to yourself. You tell me I'm negative, but when it's work that matters to me, who's negative?"
"I just don't understand why you won't even consider..."
"Enough!
If the object is to make money..."
"Enough! Enough! I don't give a damn what other people do. I'm not that kind of person." Twice in church the previous Sunday, Enid had turned her head and caught Chuck Meisner staring. She was a little fuller in the bust than usual, probably that was all. But Chuck had blushed both times.
"What is the reason you're so cold to me?" she said.
"There are reasons," Alfred said, "but I will not tell you."
"Why are you so unhappy? Why won't you tell me?"
"I will go to the grave before I tell you, to the grave.
Oh, oh, oh."
This was a bad husband she had landed, a bad, bad, bad husband who would never give her what she needed. Anything that might have satisfied her, he found a reason to withhold. And so she lay, a tantala,
beside the inert illusion of a feast. The merest finger anywhere would have, to say nothing of his split plum lips. But he was useless. A wad of money stashed in a mattress and mouldering and devaluing was what he was. A depression in the heartland had shriveled him the way it had shriveled her mother, who didn't understand that interest-bearing bank accounts were federally insured now, or that blue-chip stocks held for the long term with reinvested dividends might help provide for her old age. He was a bad investor. But she was not. She'd even been known, when a room was very dark, to take a real risk or two. And she took one now, rolled over, and tickled his thigh with breasts that a certain neighbor had admired, rested her cheek on her husband's ribs. She could feel him waiting for her to go away, but first she had to stroke the plane of his muscled belly, hover-gliding, touching hair but no skin. To her mild surprise, she felt his coming to life at the approach of her fingers. His groin tried to dodge her, but the fingers were more nimble. She could feel him growing to manhood through the fly of his pajamas. And in an access of pent-up hunger, she did a thing he'd never let her do before. She bent sideways and took it into her mouth. It, the rapidly growing boy, the faintly urinary dumpling. In the skill of her hands and the swelling of her breasts, she felt desirable and capable of anything. The man beneath her shook with resistance. She freed her mouth momentarily. "Al, sweetie?"
"Enid, what are you?"
Again her open mouth descended on the cylinder of flesh. She held still for a moment, long enough to feel the flesh harden pulse by pulse against her palate. Then she raised her head. "We could have a little extra money in the bank, you think? Take the boys to Disneyland, you think?" Back under she went. Tongue and penis were approaching an understanding, and he tasted like the inside of her mouth now. Like a chore, and all the word implied. Perhaps, involuntarily, he kneed her in the ribs, and she shifted, still feeling desirable. She stuffed her mouth and the top of her throat, surfaced for air, and took another big gulp. "Even just to invest 2,000, she murmured, "with a $4 differential. Ack!" Alfred had come to his senses and forced the succubus away from him. "Schopenhauer. The people who make money are men, not women. And from this it follows that women are neither justified in having unconditional possession of it, nor fit persons to be entrusted with its administration." The succubus reached for him again, but he grabbed her wrist and with his other hand pulled her nightgown up. "Maybe the pleasures of a swing set, likewise of sky and scuba diving, were tastes from a time when the uterus held you harmless from the claims of up and down. A time when you hadn't acquired the mechanics even to experience vertigo. Still luxuriated safely in a warm inland sea. Only this tumble was scary. This tumble came accompanied by a rush of blood-borne adrenaline as the mother appeared to be in some distress. Al, not sure it's a good idea, isn't? I don't think the book says there is nothing wrong. Uneasy about this, though. Ooh, really, Al?" He was a man having lawful sexual intercourse with his lawful wife. "Al, though, maybe not. So..." Fighting the image of the leotarded teenaged twat and all the other cunts with their tits and their asses that a man might want to fuck, fighting it although the room was very dark and much was allowed in the dark. "Oh, I'm so unhappy about this," Enid quietly wailed. Worst was the image of the little girl curled up inside her. A girl not much larger than a large bug, but already a witness to such harm. Witness to a tautly engorged little brain that dipped in and out beyond the cervix and then, with a quick double spasm that could hardly be considered adequate warning, spat thick alkaline webs of spunk into her private room. Not even born, and already drenched in sticky knowledge. Alfred lay catching his breath and repenting his defiling of the baby. A last child was a last opportunity to learn from one's mistakes and make corrections. And he resolved to seize this opportunity. From the day she was born, he would treat her more gently than he treated Gary or Chipper. relax the law for her, indulge her outright even, and never once force her to sit at the table after everyone was gone. But he'd squirted such filth on her when she was helpless. She'd witnessed such scenes of marriage, and so, of course, when she was older, she betrayed him. What made correction possible also doomed it. The sensitive probe that had given him readings at the top end of the red zone now read zero. He pulled away and squared his shoulders to his wife. Under the spell of the sexual instinct, as Arthur Schopenhauer called it, he'd lost sight of how cruelly soon he had to shave and catch the train. But now the instinct was discharged, and consciousness of the remaining night's brevity weighed on his chest like number 140 rail stock. And Enid had begun to cry again, as wives did, when the hour was psychotically late and tampering with the alarm clock was not an option. Years ago, when they were first married, she'd sometimes cried in the wee hours, but then Alfred had felt such gratitude for the pleasure he'd stolen and the stabbing she'd endured that he never failed to ask why she was crying. Tonight, notably, he felt neither gratitude nor the remotest obligation to quiz her. He felt sleepy. Why did wives choose night to cry in? Crying at night was all very well if you didn't have to catch a train to work in 4 hours, and if you hadn't, moments ago, committed a defilement in pursuit of a satisfaction whose importance now entirely escaped you. Maybe it took all this. 10 nights of wakefulness and bad motels, followed by an evening on the emotional roller coaster, and finally the run outside and put a bullet through the roof of your mouth, sucking and mewling noises of a wife trying to cry herself to sleep at 2 in the goddamn morning to open his eyes to the fact that, A, sleep was a woman, and B, hers were comforts that he was under no obligation to refuse. For a man who all his life had fought off extracurricular napping like any other unwholesome delight, the discovery was life-altering, no less momentous in its way than his discovery hours earlier of electrical anisotropism in a gel of networked ferroacetates. More than 30 years would pass before the discovery in the basement bore financial fruit. The discovery in the bedroom made existence, Shea Lambert, more bearable immediately. A pox somnus is descended on the household. Alfred's new lover soothed whatever beast was left in him. How much easier than raging or sulking he found it to simply close his eyes. Soon everybody understood that he had an invisible mistress whom he entertained in the family room on Saturday afternoon when his work week at the Mid-Pack ended, a mistress he took along with him on every business trip and fell into the arms of in beds that no longer seemed uncomfortable in motel rooms, that no longer seemed so noisy. A mistress he never failed to visit in the course of an evening's paperwork. A mistress with whom he shared a travel pillow after lunch on family summer trips while Enid lurchingly piloted the car and the kids in the back seat hushed. Sleep was the ideally work-compatible girl he ought to have married in the first place. Perfectly submissive, infinitely forgiving, and so respectable you could take her to church and the symphony and the St. Jude Repertory Theater. She never kept him awake with her tears. She demanded nothing, and in return for nothing gave him everything he needed to do a long day's work. There was no mess in their affair, no romantic osculation, no leakages or secretions, no shame. He could cheat on Enid in Enid's own bed without giving her a shred of legally admissible proof. And as long as he kept the affair private, to the extent of not dozing at dinner parties, Enid tolerated it, as sensible wives had always done. And so it was an infidelity for which, as the decades passed, there never seemed to come a reckoning.
"Psst! Asshole!"
With a jolt, Alfred awakened to the tremor and slow pitching of the Gunnar Myrdal. Someone else was in the stateroom?
"Asshole!"
"Who's there?" he asked, half in challenge, half in fear. Thin Scandinavian blankets fell away as he sat up and peered into the semi-darkness, straining to hear past the boundaries of his self. The partially deaf
know, like cellmates, the frequencies at which their heads ring. His oldest companion was a contralto like a pipe organ's middle A, a clarion blare vaguely localized in his left ear. He'd known this tone, at growing volumes, for 30 years. It was such a fixture that it seemed it should outlive him. It had the pristine meaninglessness of eternal or infinite things, was as real as a heartbeat but corresponded to no real thing outside him, was a sound that nothing made. Underneath it, the fainter and more fugitive tones were active, cirrus-like clusterings of very high frequencies off in deep stratosphere behind his ears. Meandering notes of almost ghostly faintness as from a remote calliope. A jangly set of mid-range tones that waxed and waned like crickets in the center of his skull. A low, almost rumbling drone, like a dilution of a diesel engine's blanket all-deafeningness. A sound he'd never quite believed was real, that is, unreal, until he'd retired from the mid-pack and lost touch with locomotives. These were the sounds his brain both created and listened to, was friendly with. Outside of himself, he could hear the psh-psh of two hands gently swinging on their hinges in the sheets, and the mysterious rush of water all around him in the Gunnar Myrdal's secret capillaries. And someone snickering down in the dubious space below the horizon of the bedding. And the alarm clock pinching off each tick. It was 3 in the morning, and his mistress had abandoned him. Now, when he needed her comforts more than ever, she went off whoring with younger sleepers. For 30 years she'd obliged him, spread her arms and opened her legs every night at 10:15. She'd been the nook he sought, the womb. He could still find her in the afternoon or early evening, but not in a bed at night. As soon as he lay down, he groped in the sheets and sometimes, for a few hours, found some bony extremity of hers to clutch. But reliably, at 1 or 2 or 3, she vanished beyond any pretending that she still belonged to him. He peered fearfully across the rust-orange carpeting to the Nordic blonde wood lines of Enid's bed. Enid appeared to be dead. The rushing water in the million pipes. And the tremor. He had a guess about this tremor, that it came from the engines, that when you built a luxury cruise ship, you damped or masked every sound the engines made, one after another, right down to the lowest audible frequency and even lower. But you couldn't go all the way to zero. You were left with this subaudible 2 hertz shaking, the irreducible remainder and reminder of a silence imposed on something powerful. A small animal, a mouse, scurried in the layered shadows at the foot of Enid's bed. For a moment it seemed to Alfred that the whole floor consisted of scurrying corpuscles. Then the mice resolved themselves into a single, more forward mouse, horrible mouse, squishable pellets of excreta, habits of gnawing, heedless peeings.
"Asshole! Asshole!"
the visitor taunted, stepping from the darkness into a bedside dusk. With dismay, Alfred recognized the visitor. First, he saw the droppings' slumped outline, and then he caught a whiff of bacterial decay. This was not a mouse. This was the turd.
"You're in trouble now,"
the turd said. It was a sociopathic turd, a loose stool, a motor mouth. It had introduced itself to Alfred the night before and so agitated him that only Enid's ministrations, a blaze of electric light and Enid's soothing touch on his shoulder, had saved the night. "Leave," Alfred commanded sternly. But the turd scurried up the side of the clean Nordic bed and relaxed like a brie or a leafy and manure-smelling cabrales on the covers.
"Splat chance of that fella!"
And dissolved, literally, in a gale of hilarious fart sounds. To fear encountering the turd on his pillow was to summon the turd to the pillow, where it flopped in postures of glistening well-being.
"Get away! Get away!"
Alfred said, planting an elbow in the carpeting as he exited the bed headfirst.
"No way, Jose,"
the turd said. "First I'm going to get in your clothes."
"No,
Sure am, fella. Gonna get in your clothes and touch the upholstery. Gonna smear and leave a trail. Gonna stink so bad.
Why? Why? Why would you do such a thing?
Because it's right for me, the turd croaked. It's who I am. Put somebody else's comfort ahead of my own? Go hop in a toilet to spare somebody else's feelings? That's the kind of thing you do, fella. You get everything bass-ackwards, and look where it's landed you.
Other people ought to have more consideration. You ought to have less.
Me, personally, I am opposed to all strictures. If you feel it, let it rip. If you want it, go for it. Dude's got to put his own interests first.
Civilization depends upon restraint, Alfred said.
Civilization? Overrated. I ask you, what's it ever done for me? Flush me down the toilet. Treated me like shit.
But that's what you are, Alfred pleaded, hoping the turd might see the logic. That's what a toilet is for.
Who are you calling shit here, asshole? I got the same rights as everybody else, don't I? Life, liberty, the pursuit of hot pussiness? That's what it says in the Constitution of the United...
That's not right, Alfred said. You're thinking of the Declaration of Independence.
Some old yellow piece of paper somewhere. What the rat-ass fuck do I care what exact paper? Tight asses like you've been correcting every fucking word out of my mouth since I was yay big. You and all the constipated fascist school teachers and Nazi cops. For all I care, the words are printed on a piece of fucking toilet paper. I say it's a free country. I am in the majority, and you, fella, are a minority, and so fuck you.
The turd had an attitude, a tone of voice that Alfred found eerily familiar but couldn't quite place. It began to roll and tumble on his pillow, spreading a shiny, greenish-brown film with little lumps and fibers in it, leaving white creases and hollows where the fabric was bunched. Alfred, on the floor by the bed, covered his nose and mouth with his hands to mitigate the stench and horror. Then the turd ran up the leg of his pajamas. He felt its tickling, mouse-like feet.
"Enid!" he called with all the strength he had.
The turd was somewhere in the neighborhood of his upper thighs. Struggling to bend his rigid legs and hook his semi-functional thumbs on the waistband, he pulled the pajamas down to trap the turd inside the fabric. He suddenly understood that the turd was an escaped convict, a piece of human refuse that belonged in jail. That this was what jail was for, people who believed that they, rather than society, made the rules. And if jail did not deter them, they deserved death. Death! Drawing strength from his rage, Alfred succeeded in pulling the ball of pajamas from his feet, and with oscillating arms he wrestled the ball to the carpeting, hammering it with his forearms, and then wedged it deep between the firm Nordic mattress and the Nordic box spring. He knelt, catching his breath, in his pajama top and adult diaper. Enid continued to sleep. Something distinctly fairy-tale-like in her attitude tonight.
"Blath!" the turd taunted.
It had reappeared on the wall above Alfred's bed and hung precariously as if flung there beside a framed etching of the Oslo waterfront.
"God damn you," Alfred said. "You belong in jail."
The turd wheezed with laughter as it slid very slowly down the wall, its viscous pseudopods threatening to drip on the sheets below.
"Seems to me," it said, "you anal-retentive-type personalities want everything in jail, like little kids. Bad news, man. They pull your tchotchkes off your shelves. They drop food on the carpet. They cry in theaters. They miss the pot. Put them in the slammer. And Polynesians, man, they track sand in the house, get fish juice on the furniture, and all those pubescent chickies with their honkers exposed. Jail them. And how about 10 to 20 while we're at it for every horny little teenager? I mean, talk about insolence. Talk about no restraint."
"And Negroes, sore topic, Fred? I'm hearing rambunctious shouting and interesting grammar. I'm smelling liquor of the malt variety and sweat that's very rich and scalpy. And all that dancing and whoopee-making and singers that coo like body parts wetted with saliva and special jellies. What's a jail for if not to toss a Negro in it? And your Caribbeans, with their spliffs and their pot-belly toddlers and their, like, daily barbecues and rat-borne hantaviruses and sugary drinks with pig blood at the bottom? Slam the cell door, eat the key. And the Chinese, man, those creepy-ass weird-named vegetables, like homegrown dildos somebody forgot to wash after using. $1, $1. And those slimy carps, and skinned-alive songbirds, and come on, like puppy dog soup, and putty-tat dumplings, and female infants are national delicacies, and pork bung.
by which we're referring here to the anus of a swine, presumably a sort of chewy and bristly type item. Pork bung's a thing chinks pay money for to eat? What say we just nuke all 1.2 billion of 'em, hey? Clean that part of the world up already. And let's not forget about women, generally. Nothing but a trail of Kleenexes and Tampaxes everywhere they go. And your fairies, with their doctor's office lubricants, and your Mediterraneans with their whiskers and their garlic, and your French with their garter belts and raunchy cheeses, and your blue-collar ball-scratchers with their hot rods and beer belches, and your Jews with their circumcised putzes and gefilte fish like pickled turds, and your wasps with their cigarette boats and runny-assed polo horses and go-to-hell cigars. Hey, funny thing, Fred. The only people that don't belong in your jail are upper-middle-class Northern European men. And you're on my case for wanting things my way?
What will it take to make you leave this room? Alfred said.
Loosen up the old sphincter, fella. Let it fly.
I will never.
In that case, I might pay a visit to your shaving kit. Have me a little episode of diarrhea on your toothbrush. Drop a couple nice globets in your shave cream, and tomorrow a.m. you can lather up a rich brown foam. Enid...
Alfred said in a strained voice, not taking his eyes off the crafty turd. "I am having difficulties. I would appreciate your assistance." His voice ought to have awakened her, but her sleep was snow-white-like in its depth.
"Enid, darling," the turd mocked in a David Niven accent, "I should most appreciate some assistance at your earliest possible convenience."
Unconfirmed reports from nerves in the small of Alfred's back and behind his knees indicated that additional turd units were in the vicinity. Turdish rebels, snuffling stealthily about, spending themselves in trails of fetor.
"Food and pussy, fella,"
said the leader of the turds, now barely clinging to the wall by one pseudopod of fecal mousse,
"is what it all comes down to. Everything else, and I say this in all modesty, is pure shit."
Then the pseudopod ruptured, and the leader of the turds, leaving behind on the wall a small clump of putrescence, plunged with a cry of glee onto a bed that belonged to Nordic Pleasure Lines and was due to be made in a few hours by a lovely young Finnish woman. Imagining this clean, pleasant housekeeper finding lumps of personal excrement spattered on the bedspread was almost more than Alfred could bear. His peripheral vision was alive with writhing stool now. He had to hold things together, suspecting that a leak in the toilet might be the source of his trouble. He made his way on hands and knees into the bathroom and kicked the door shut behind him. Rotated with relative ease on the smooth tiles, braced his back against the door and pushed his feet against the sink opposite him. He laughed for a moment at the absurdity of his situation. Here he was, an American executive, sitting in diapers on the floor of a floating bathroom under siege by a squadron of feces. The person got the strangest notions late at night. The light was better in the bathroom. There was a science of cleanliness, a science of looks, a science even of excretion, as evidenced by the outsized Swiss porcelain egg cup of a toilet, a regally pedestaled thing with finely knurled levers of control. In these more congenial surroundings, Alfred was able to collect himself to the point of understanding that the Turdish rebels were figments, that to some extent he had been dreaming, and that the source of his anxiety was simply a drainage problem. Unfortunately, operations were shut down for the night. There was no way to have a look personally at the rupture, nor any way to put a plumber's snake or video cam down there. Highly unlikely, as well, that a contractor could get a rig out to the site under conditions like these. Alfred wasn't even sure he could pinpoint his location on a map himself. There was nothing for it but to wait until morning. Absent a full solution, two half-solutions were better than no solution at all. You tackled the problem with whatever you had in hand. Couple of extra diapers, that ought to hold for a few hours, and here were the diapers, right by the toilet, in a bag. It was nearly 4 o'clock. There would be hell to pay if the district manager wasn't at his desk by 7. Alfred couldn't recollect the fellow's exact name, not that it mattered. Just call the office and whoever picked up the phone. It was characteristic of the modern world, though, wasn't it? How slippery they made the goddamn tape on the diapers. "Would you look at that?" he said, hoping to pass off as philosophical amusement his rage with a treacherous modernity. The adhesive strips might as well have been covered with Teflon. Between his dry skin and his shakes, peeling the backing off a strip was like picking up a marble with two peacock feathers.
"Well, for goodness sake!"
He persisted in the attempt for 5 minutes, and another 5 minutes. He simply couldn't get the backing off.
"Well, for goodness sake!"
Grinning at his own incapacity, grinning in frustration and the overwhelming sense of being watched.
"Well, for goodness sake!"
he said once more. This phrase often proved useful in dissipating the shame of small failures. How changeful a room was in the night! By the time Alfred had given up on the adhesive strips and simply yanked a third diaper up his thigh as far as it would go, which regrettably wasn't far, he was no longer in the same bathroom. The light had a new clinical intensity. He felt the heavy hand of a more extremely late hour.
"Enid," he called, "can you help me?"
With 50 years of experience as an engineer, he could see at a glance that the emergency contractor had botched the job. One of the diapers was twisted nearly inside out, and a second had a mildly spastic leg sticking through two of its plies, leaving most of its absorptive capacity unrealized in a folded mass, its adhesive stickers adhering to nothing. Alfred shook his head. He couldn't blame the contractor. The fault was his own. Never should have undertaken a job like this under conditions like these. Poor judgment on his part. Trying to do damage control, blundering around in the dark, often created more problems than it solved.
"Yes, now we are in a fine mess," he said with a bitter smile.
"And could this be liquid on the floor?" "Oh, my lord, there appeared to be some liquid on the floor. Also liquid running in the Gunnar Myrdal's myriad pipes."
"Enid, please, for God's sake, I am asking you for help."
No answer from the district office. Some kind of vacation everybody was on. Something about the color of a fall. Liquid on the floor. Liquid on the floor. So all right, though. They paid him to take responsibility. They paid him to make the hard calls. He took a deep, bolstering breath. In a crisis like this, the first order of business was obviously to clear a path for the runoff. Forget about track repair. First you had to have a gradient, or you risked a really major washout. He noted grimly that he had nothing like a surveyor's transit, not even a simple plumb line. He'd have to eyeball it. How the hell had he got stranded out here anyway? Probably not even 5 in the morning yet. "Remind me to call the district manager at 7, he said. Somewhere, of course, a dispatcher had to be on duty. But then the problem was to find a telephone, and here a curious reluctance to raise his eyes above the level of the toilet made itself felt. Conditions in these parts were impossible. It could be mid-morning by the time he found a telephone, and by that point... "Oh, such a lot of work," he said. There appeared to be a slight depression in the shower stall. Yes, in fact, a pre-existing culvert, maybe some old Department of Transportation road-building project that never got off the ground. Maybe the Army Corps was involved somehow. One of those midnight serendipities, a real culvert. Still, he was looking at a hell of an engineering problem to relocate the operation to take advantage of the culvert. Not much choice, though, I'm afraid. Might as well get at it. He wasn't getting any less tired. Think of the Dutch with their Delta project. 40 years of battling the sea. Put things in perspective a little. One bad night. He'd endured worse. Try to build some redundancy into the fix. That was the plan. No way he'd trust one little culvert to handle all the runoff. There could be a backup farther down the line. "And then we're in trouble," he said. "Then we are in real trouble." Could be a hell of a lot worse, in fact. They were lucky an engineer was right on site when the water broke through. Imagine if he hadn't been here. What a mess. Could have been a real disaster. First order of business was to slap some sort of temporary patch on the leak, then tackle the logistical nightmare of rerouting the whole operation over the culvert, and then hope to hold things together until the sun came up. And see what we got. In the faulty light, he saw the liquid running one way across the floor, and then reversing itself slowly, as if the horizontal had lost its mind.
"Enid," he called, with little hope, as he commenced the sick-making work of stopping the leakage and getting himself back on track. And the ship sailed on.
Thanks to Aslan, registered trademark, and to young Dr. Hibbard, an outstanding, high-caliber young man, Enid was having her first solid night's sleep in many months. There were a thousand things she wanted from life, and since few were available at home with Alfred and St. Jude, she had forcibly channeled all her wanting into the numbered days, the Mayfly lifetime that the luxury cruise would last. For months, the cruise had been her mind's safe parking space, the future that made her present bearable. And after her afternoon in New York had proved deficient in the fun department, she boarded the Gunnar Myrdal with her hungers redoubled. Fun was being had buoyantly on every deck by cliques of seniors enjoying their retirement the way she wished Alfred would enjoy his. Although Nordic Pleasure Lines was emphatically not a discount line, this cruise had been booked almost entirely by large groups such as the University of Rhode Island Alumni Association, American Hadassah of Chevy Chase, Maryland, the 85th Airborne Sky Devil Division Reunion, and the Dade County, Florida Duplicate Bridge League Senior Flight. Widows in excellent health guided one another by the elbow to special mustering places where name tags and information packets were distributed, and the preferred token of mutual recognition was the glass-shattering scream. Already seniors intent on savoring every minute of precious cruise time were drinking the frozen cocktail du jour, a lingonberry lap frap, from schooners that took two hands to handle safely. Others crowded the rails of lower decks, the ones sheltered from the rain, and scanned Manhattan for a face to wave goodbye to. A combo in the ABBA show lounge was playing heavy metal polka. While Alfred had a final pre-dinner session in the bathroom, his third session inside an hour, Enid sat in the B-deck lounge and listened to the slow plant and drag of someone's walker-aided progress across the A-deck lounge above her. Apparently, the duplicate league's cruise uniform was a T-shirt with the text, "Old bridge players never die, they just lose their finesse." Enid felt the joke did not bear heavy repetition. She saw retirees running, actually lifting their feet off the ground in the direction of the lingonberry lap frap. "Of course," she murmured, reflecting on how old everyone was. "I suppose who else could afford a cruise like this?" The seeming dachshund that a man was pulling by a leash turned out to be a tank of oxygen mounted on roller skate wheels and dressed in a pet sweater. A very fat man walked by in a T-shirt that said, "Titanic, the body." You'd spent a lifetime being waited for impatiently, and now your impatient husband's minimum stay in a bathroom was 15 minutes. Old urologists never die, they just peter out. Even on nights with a casual dress code, such as tonight, T-shirts were officially discouraged. Enid had put on a wool suit and asked Alfred to wear a tie, although, given his handling of a soup spoon lately, his neckties were little more than cannon fodder on dinner's front line. She'd made him pack a dozen. She was acutely conscious that Nordic Pleasure Lines was deluxe. She expected, and had paid for, in part with her own money, elegance. Each T-shirt, she saw, was a specific small trampling of her fantasy and, hence, pleasure. It rankled her that people richer than she were so often less worthy and attractive, more slobbish and louty. Comfort could be found in being poorer than people who were smart and beautiful. But to be less affluent than these T-shirted, joke-cracking fatzos? "I am ready," Alfred announced, appearing in the lounge. He took Enid's hand for the ascent by elevator to the Søren Kierkegaard dining room. Holding his hand, she felt married and, to that extent, grounded in the universe and reconciled to old age. but she couldn't help thinking how dearly she would have treasured holding his hand in the decades when he'd stridden everywhere a pace or two ahead of her. His hand was needy and subdued now. Even tremors of his that looked violent proved to be featherweight in feel. She could sense the hand's readiness to resume its paddling as soon as it was released, however. Such travelers as were cruising without affiliation had been assigned to special dining tables for floaters. To the delight of Enid, who relished cosmopolitan company, provided it wasn't too snobbish, two of the floaters at her and Alfred's table were from Norway and two were from Sweden. Enid liked European countries small. One could learn an interesting Swedish custom or Norwegian fact without being made sensible of one's ignorance of German music, French literature, or Italian art. The usage of skål was a good example. Likewise, the fact that Norway was Europe's largest exporter of crude oil, as Mr. and Mrs. Nygren from Oslo were informing the table when the Lamberts claimed the last two seats. Enid spoke first to her left-hand neighbor, Mr. Söderblad, a reassuringly ascotted and blue-blazered older Swede.
"What's your impression of the ship so far?" she asked. "Is it really super-authentic?"
"Well, it does seem to be floating," Mr. Söderblad said with a smile, "in spite of heavy seas."
Enid raised her voice to aid his comprehension.
"I mean, is it authentically Scandinavian?"
"Well, yes, of course," Mr. Söderblad said. "At the same time, everything in the world is more and more American, don't you think?"
"But you think this captures really super well," Enid said, "the flavor of a real Scandinavian ship?"
"Actually, it is better than most ships in Scandinavia. My wife and I are quite pleased so far."
Enid abandoned her inquiry, unconvinced that Mr. Söderblad had grasped its import. It mattered to her that Europe be European. She'd visited the continent 5 times on vacation and 2 times on business trips with Alfred, so about 12 times altogether, and to friends planning tours of Spain or France, she now liked to say with a sigh that she'd had her fill of the place. It drove her crazy, however, to hear her friend B. Meisner affect the same indifference.
"I'm so sick of flying to St. Moritz for my grandson's birthdays," etc.
B.'s dim-witted and unfairly gorgeous daughter, Cindy, had married an Austrian sports doctor, Avon Somebody, who'd garnered Olympic bronze in the giant slalom. That B. continued to socialize at all with Enid amounted to a triumph of loyalty over divergent fortunes. But Enid never forgot that it was Chuck Meisner's big investment in Erie Belt stock on the eve of the mid-pack buyout that had helped fund their mansion in Paradise Valley. Chuck had become board chairman of his bank, while Alfred stalled in the mid-pack's second echelon and put his savings into inflation-prone annuities, so that even now the Lamberts could not afford Nordic Pleasure Line's quality unless Enid dipped into private funds, which she did, to escape going mad with envy.
"My best friend in St. Jude vacations at St. Moritz," she shouted, apropos essentially of nothing, in the direction of Mr. Söderblad's pretty wife. "Her Austrian son-in-law is tremendously successful and owns a chalet there."
Mrs. Söderblad was like a precious metal accessory, somewhat scuffed and tarnished by Mr. Söderblad's use. Her lip gloss, hair color, eye shadow, and nail polish rang changes on a theme of platinum. Her dinner dress was of silver lamé and afforded good views of sun-toasted shoulder and silicone augmentation.
"St. Moritz is quite beautiful," she said. "I have performed many times in St. Moritz." "You're a performer!" Enid shouted.
"Sina was a special entertainer," Mr. Söderblad said hastily.
"Those alpine resorts can be terribly overpriced," the Norwegian woman, Mrs. Nygren, observed with a shiver.
She had large, round eyeglasses and a radial distribution of face wrinkles, which together gave a mantis-like impression. Visually, she and the burnished Söderblad were mutual affronts.
"On the other hand," she continued, It is easy for us in Norway to be choosy. Even in certain of our city parks, the skiing can be top-notch. There is really nothing like it anywhere.
Of course, a distinction must be made, said Mr. Nygren, who was very tall and had ears like raw veal chops, between the alpine type of skiing and the cross-country or Nordic variety. Norway has produced outstanding alpine skiers. I mentioned the name Kjetil André Aamodt with some confidence that it will ring a bell, but it must be admitted that we have not always competed at the top level in this area. However, the cross-country or Nordic variety is quite a different story. There it is safe to say that we continue to gain more than our fair share of distinctions.
Norwegians are fantastically boring,
Mr. Söderblad said hoarsely in Enid's ear. The other two floaters at the table, a handsome older couple named Roth from Chad's Ford, Pennsylvania, had done Enid the instinctive favor of engaging Alfred in conversation. Alfred's face was flushed with soup heat, the drama of a spoon, and also, perhaps, the effort of refusing to glance even once at the dazzling Söderbladian décolletage while he explained to the Roths the mechanics of stabilizing an ocean liner. Mr. Roth, a brainy-looking man in a bow tie and eye-bloating horn rims, was peppering him with discerning questions and assimilating the answers so raptly he appeared almost shocked. Mrs. Roth was paying less attention to Alfred than to Enid. Mrs. Roth was a small woman, a handsome child in her mid-60s. Her elbows barely cleared the tabletop. She had a white-flecked black page boy and rosy cheeks and big blue eyes with which she was staring at Enid unabashedly in the way of someone very smart or very stupid. Such a crush-like intensity of looking suggested hunger. Enid sensed immediately that Mrs. Roth would become her great friend on the cruise, or else her great rival, and so, with something like coquetry, she declined to speak to her, or otherwise acknowledge her attention. As steaks were brought to the table and devastated lobsters taken away, she repeatedly thrust, and Mr. Söderblad repeatedly parried, questions concerning his occupation, which appeared to involve the arms trade. She soaked up Mrs. Roth's blue-eyed gaze, along with the envy that she imagined the floaters were provoking at other tables. She supposed that, to the hoi polloi in their T-shirts, the floaters looked extremely continental. A touch of distinction here, beauty, neckties, an ascot, a certain cachet.
"Sometimes I get so excited thinking about my morning coffee," Mr. Söderblad said, "I can't fall asleep at night."
Enid's hopes that Alfred might take her dancing in the peepee long-stocking ballroom were dashed when he stood up and announced that he was going to bed. It wasn't even 7 o'clock yet. Who ever heard of a grown-up going to bed at 7 in the evening?
"Sit down and wait for dessert," she said. "The desserts are supposed to be divine."
Alfred's unsightly napkin fell from his thighs to the floor. He seemed without inkling of how much he was embarrassing and disappointing her.
"You stay," he said. "I've had enough."
And away across the Søren Kierkegaard broadloom he lurched, battling shifts in the horizontal which had grown more pronounced since the ship left New York Harbor. Familiar waves of sorrow for all the fun she couldn't have with such a husband dampened Enid's spirits until it occurred to her that she now had a long evening to herself and no Alfred to spoil her fun. She brightened, and brightened further when Mr. Roth departed for the Knut Hamsun reading room, leaving his wife at the table. Mrs. Roth switched seats to be closer to Enid.
"We Norwegians are great readers," Mrs. Nygren took the opportunity to remark.
"And great yakkers," Mr. Söderblad muttered.
"Public libraries and bookstores in Oslo are thriving," Mrs. Nygren informed the table.
"I think it is not the same elsewhere. Reading is mostly in decline around the world, but not in Norway. My pair is reading the complete works of John Galsworthy for the second time this autumn in English."
"No, Inga, no," Per Nygren whinnied. "Third time."
"My God,"
said Mr. Sirrablood.
"It's true."
Mrs. Nigren looked at Enid and Mrs. Roth as though anticipating awe.
"Each year, Pear reads one work by every winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature, and also the complete works of his favorite winner from his previous year's reading. And you see, each year the task becomes a bit more difficult because there has been another winner, you see."
"It is a bit like raising the bar in a high jump," Pear explained. "Every year a bit more challenging."
Mr. Söderblad, who by Enid's count was drinking his eighth cup of coffee, leaned close to her and said,
"My God, these people are boring."
"It is safe to say that I have read more deeply into Henrik Pontoppidan than most," Per Nygren said. Mrs. Söderblad tilted her head, smiling dreamily.
"Do you know," she said, perhaps to Enid or to Mrs. Roth, "that until 100 years ago, Norway was a colony of Sweden."
The Norwegians erupted like a batted hive.
"Colony? Colony?
Oh, oh," Inga Nygren hissed. "I think there is a history here that our American friends deserve to—"
"This is a story of strategic alliances," Per declared.
"By colony, what is the exact word in Swedish that you are groping for, Mrs. Söderblad? Since my English is obviously much stronger than yours, perhaps I can offer our American friends a more accurate translation, such as, equal partner in a unified peninsular kingdom."
"Senior," Mr. Söderblad observed wickedly to his wife, "I do believe you've hit a nerve." He raised a hand. "Waiter, refill!"
"If one chooses as a vantage point the late 9th century, Per Nygren said, "and I suspect that even our Swedish friends will concede that the ascension of Harald the Blonde is quite a reasonable hopping-off place for our examination of the seesaw relationship of two great rival powers, or should I perhaps say three great powers, since Denmark as well plays a rather fascinating role in our story."
"We'd love to hear it, but maybe another time," Mrs. Roth interrupted, leaning over to touch Enid's hand. "Remember we said 7 o'clock?
Enid was only briefly bewildered. She excused herself and followed Mrs. Roth into the main hall, where they encountered a crush of seniors and gastric aromas, disinfectant aromas.
"Enid, I'm Sylvia," said Mrs. Roth. "How do you feel about slot machines? I've had a physical craving all day." "Oh, me too," Enid said. "I think they're in the Strindberg room."
"Strindberg, yes."
Enid admired quickness of mind, but seldom credited herself with possessing it.
"Thanks for the, you know," she said as she followed Sylvia Roth through the crush. "Rescue, don't mention it."
The Strindberg room was packed with kibitzers, low-stakes blackjack players, and lovers of the slot. Enid couldn't remember when she'd had so much fun. The fifth quarter she dropped brought her 3 plums. As if so much fruit upset the bowels of her machine, specie gushed from its nether parts. She shoveled her take into a plastic bucket. 11 quarters later it happened again, 3 cherries, a silver dump. White-haired players losing steadily at neighboring machines gave her dirty looks.
"I'm embarrassed," she told herself, although she wasn't.
Decades of insufficient affluence had made her a disciplined investor. From her winnings, she set aside the amount of her initial investment. Half of every payoff she also salted away. Her playing fund showed no sign of exhaustion, however.
"So I've had my fix," Sylvia Roth said after nearly an hour, tapping Enid on the shoulder. "Shall we go hear the string quartet?" "Yes, yes, it's in the Grieg room."
"Grieg," said Sylvia, laughing.
"Oh, that is funny, isn't it? Grieg, I am so stupid tonight."
"How much did you make? You seemed to be doing well."
"I'm not sure. I didn't count."
Sylvia smiled at her intently.
"I think you did, though. I think you counted exactly." "All right," Enid said, blushing because she was liking Sylvia so much. "It was $130.
A portrait of Edvard Grieg hung in a room of actual gilt ornateness that recalled the 18th-century splendor of Sweden's royal court. The large number of empty chairs confirmed Enid's suspicion that many of the crew's participants were low class.
She'd been on cruises where the classical concerts were SRO. Although Sylvia seemed less than knocked dead by the musicians, Enid thought they were wonderful. They played, from memory, popular classical tunes such as Swedish Rhapsody and excerpts from Finlandia and Peer Gynt. In the middle of Peer Gynt, the second violinist turned green and left the room for a minute. The sea really was a bit stormy, but Enid had a strong stomach and Sylvia had a patch. And then returned to his chair and managed to find his place again without, as it were, missing a beat. The 20 people in the audience shouted, "Bravo!" At the elegant reception afterward, Enid spent 7.7% of her gambling earnings on a cassette tape recorded by the quartet. She tried a complimentary glass of Spug, a Swedish liqueur currently enjoying a $15 million marketing campaign. Spug tasted like vodka, sugar, and horseradish, which, in fact, were its ingredients. As their fellow guests reacted to Spug with looks of surprise and reproach, Enid and Sylvia fell to giggling.
"Special treat," Sylvia said. "Complimentary Spug. Try some."
"Yum," Enid said in stitches, snorting for air.
"Spug."
Then it was on to the Ibsen promenade for the scheduled 10 o'clock ice cream social. In the elevator, it seemed to Enid that the ship was suffering not only from a seesaw motion, but also from a yaw, as if its bow were the face of someone experiencing repugnance. Leaving the elevator, she almost fell over a man on his hands and knees, like half a two-man prank involving shoving. On the back of his T-shirt was a punchline, "They just lose their aim." Enid accepted an ice cream soda from a food handler in a toque. Then she initiated an exchange of family data with Sylvia, which quickly became an exchange more of questions than of answers. It was Enid's habit, when she sensed that family was not a person's favorite topic, to probe the sore relentlessly. She would sooner have died than admit that her own children disappointed her, but hearing of other people's disappointing children, their squalid divorces, their substance abuse, their foolish investments, made her feel better. On the surface, Sylvia Roth had nothing to be ashamed of. Her sons were both in California, one in medicine and the other in computers, and both were married. Yet they seemed to be hot conversational sands to be avoided or crossed at a sprint.
"Your daughter went to Swarthmore," she said.
"Yes, briefly," Enid said.
"So, and 5 grandsons, though. My goodness, how old is the youngest?"
"He was 2 last month."